worried about climate change? Where are the plans to solve this crisis? This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock with a review of the 5 best climate solution speeches of 2006. I'll also tell you where you can get those speeches for free. Let's see what practical steps we can take to avert climate catastrophe. Will it be a happy or a grim new year? In 2006, the Arctic melted more. Rains fell heavier. Fires burned bigger. The plants and animals were confused by a changing climate. This was the year polls showed the public is getting it. People are worried, and unlikely characters and corporations are calling themselves green. It was also the year of plans to avert climate catastrophe. Most of these proposals did not come from governments who are still, with a few exceptions, in paralysis or denial. The visionaries are self-appointed, yet generally they are world-watching veterans and professional communicators. We are talking about Al Gore, the former politician, Amory Lovins, a Green gone big time, British journalist sensation George Monbiot, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigator Ross Gelbspan, the official World Watcher, Lester Brown, and perhaps urban critic James Howard Kunstler with the Peak Oil Movement. Radio EcoShock has assembled their latest speeches on how to get out of the heat in a special section of free downloads at www.ecoshock.org. Of course, there is an official plan of sorts. The Kyoto Protocol was organized by world governments, prodded on by the world's largest group of peer-reviewed, climate-related scientists. It is a start, but half dead without the world's biggest atmospheric polluter, the United States. Kyoto expires in 2012. It doesn't have teeth to really accomplish much. Most governments give Kyoto lip service only, while actually increasing their greenhouse gas pollution. Beyond Kyoto, there is only the recent failed Nairobi Climate Conference and an agreement to talk more. When it comes to the big, big reduction really needed to have any impact on human-induced climate change, proponents of the Kyoto Protocol admit this plan won't save us. At the other extreme, from the governments are the survivalists, whose only plan is to grow local food, get off the grid, and wait for the crash. We might include urban critics like James Howard Kunstler and the Peak Oil crowd. They think oil and gas supplies will dwindle even as world demand multiplies. They may be right, but if we just burn the remainder, the climate will spin out of control long before oil shortage forces a major social adjustment. Worse, humans might just use even more coal, and there is plenty of coal. One of the best peak oil sites is www.globalpublicmedia.com. Still others think big climate change is already upon us. Plans to limit CO2 to stop even worse heat and storms may be needed, but we also require more urgent plans just to survive it. For example, James Lovelock is calling for new dikes to protect the City of London and much of the southern English coast from the ravages of rising seas and strong storms. New Orleans and New York also need protection. Most of the less developed low-lying countries, such as Bangladesh, may be unable to mount any climate defenses in time. We also have the plans of geoengineers. One example? The people who would shoot gazillions of tiny mirrors into outer space to block some of the sun's rays and thus cool off the Earth. I can't go into all those plans here, but George Monbiot offers this important caution. Even if we could succeed with such a wild space adventure and cool down the sun without damaging the natural world, we would still have to turn off the carbon smokestacks. That's because all that carbon is being absorbed by the ocean, and that makes the ocean so acidic that basic life forms, like plankton, may not survive. It's not just the heat. We have to reduce the impact of carbon on the oceans as well. Today, you and I are going to rumble through 5 plans to avert climate catastrophe, from people serving as spark plugs for the public mind. Let's start with the most famous man in climate change, Al Gore Jr. The former vice president, and almost president of the United States, needs no formal introduction. And he has real climate credentials. Gore began his climate fixation as a convert in college under the scientist Roger Revelle. Al Gore brought the issue to government very early and published his book Earth in Balance in 1992. Al Gore is now known for his movie presentation, An Inconvenient Truth. There is also a book version published by Rodale Books. But since that unlikely bestseller, Gore has graduated from warning about climate change to a grassroots plan to push the American and world public into demand for change. As a whole chorus of people convert to climate reality through Inconvenient Truth, Gore has become a kind of clearinghouse and meeting place. He's part Hollywood and a mixture of scientists, businessmen, and believers who want a new vision of not just America, but the world energy economy. What is Al Gore's plan? First of all, Gore continues his initial role of awakening millions of people to the awful truth we face as the climate becomes unhinged. He used part of his profits earned by the movie and personal appearances to create a new institute called the Alliance for Climate Protection, based in San Francisco. As the new year of 2007 arrived, about 1,000 volunteer communicators assembled for a combination pep talk, media training, and grassroots organizing of inconvenient parties. These will be local events and may be large or living room size, like climate Tupperware parties. They aim to move people from worry to action. These will be, well, the new evangelists or agents of social change to save the Earth's climate as we know it. In recent speeches, Gore has also outlined a larger political plan centered in America but reaching the whole world. It is essentially a Made in America plan to sell to U.S. voters. Gore envisions a revamping of the failing U.S. industrial sector to produce prodigious amounts of alternative carbon-free energy tech. These mass-produced solar panels, windmills, and super-efficient vehicles will fill the freighters that currently leave American ports empty, having disgorged their load of consumer goods. As reported in the Washington Post of September 19, 2006, and in Gore's speech, Solving the Climate Crisis, he proposes a carbon-neutral mortgage association. This would let homeowners stretch out the increased costs of more insulation, solar panels, and energy-efficient houses as part of the mortgage, and these costs should pay for themselves as energy bills will be less. Gore also wants to revamp the electricity distribution system to let homeowners and business sell their own electricity back to the grid. He calls it the Electronet. Here is just one of a series of proposals made by Al Gore in his September 2006 speech, Solving the Climate Crisis.
Shifting to a greater reliance on ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, butanol, and green diesel fuels will not only reduce global warming pollution and enhance our national security and economic security, it will also reverse the steady loss of jobs and income in rural America. Several important building blocks for our solutions to the climate crisis can be found in new approaches to agriculture. As pointed out by the 25 by 25 movement, aimed at securing 25% of America's power and transportation fuels from agricultural sources by the year 2025, we can revitalize the farm economy by shifting its mission from a traditional focus on food, feed, and fiber to a focus on food, feed, fiber, fuel, and ecosystem services. We can restore the health of depleted soils by encouraging and rewarding the growing of fuel source crops like switchgrass and sawgrass using no-till cultivation, scientific crop rotation. We should reward farmers for planting more trees and sequestering more carbon and recognize the economic value of their stewardship of resources that are important to the health of the ecosystems that support our lives.
Like several other climate planners we will meet, Gore sees our carbon fix as a challenge that can save rather than wreck America. Alternative energy will end dependence on oil from unstable regions, make the U.S. self-sufficient, and rebuild its manufacturing preeminence. At the same time, this new tech renaissance will give energy to billions of people in the developing world without harming the world's atmosphere. Unlike other speakers we will meet, Gore doesn't go into the details of how this transfer of new wealth will take place. Gore's plan targets America and may well be part of a political platform for himself or others in the 2008 elections. And everyone knows America certainly needs a plan, an exit strategy from the deadly carbon fix. Let's move to another long-timer, Lester Brown, the founder of World Watch Institute. Brown is almost an institutional environmentalist. For more than two decades, he has been counting up the world's resources and identifying trends. His statistics have been used by people with widely different agendas. He perceives Earth as a limited system with finite resources that dwindle not only as human population grows, but as those humans adopt more consumerism. In 2004, Brown proposed what he calls Plan B. Our present direction, Plan A, isn't working. Lester Brown has a relatively comprehensive alternative direction that employs existing institutions, whether governments, banks, or large nonprofits. He relies on reforming trade and agriculture, for example, rather than counting on new technology or a radical change in our social system. One of the key indicators pursued by the World Watch Institute under Lester Brown was world grain stocks. Both production and backup supplies of grain are falling due to water shortages, soil depletion, increased population pressure, and climate change. In many parts of the world, such as the grain-growing areas of India, the crop depends on pumping fossil fuel water from long ago from ever-falling water tables. His Plan B calls for three major changes of direction. First of all, we must learn to use water much more efficiently all over the planet. This includes recycling wastewater in the world's megacities. Agriculture needs to use seasonal rains rather than draining aquifers. None of that works without reducing the pressure of new population. We're adding between 75 and 100 million new mouths to feed every year, and we have already bypassed sustainable food production. Brown's third vector of change is to cut carbon emissions in half in the next 10 years to preserve the climate. His book, Plan B, describes various tools we can use, from new fossil fuels, conservation, and rethinking society. Here is a clip from Lester Brown's speech, Plan B.
The residential electricity needs of 40 million Europeans are being satisfied by wind-generated electricity. Now, the European Wind Energy Association last November projects that by 2020, 16 years from now, half of Europe could be getting its residential electricity from wind power. In March of this year, a European wind energy consulting firm said that if European governments get serious about developing their offshore wind capacity, that by 2020, Europe could be getting all of its residential electricity needs from wind. It's a huge resource. In the United States, there are now commercial wind farms in 22 states, that is, commercial wind farms feeding electricity into the grid. In 1991, the U.S. Department of Energy did a national wind resource inventory in which they pointed out that three of our 50 states, North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas, have enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national electricity needs. And people said, wow, because many people thought wind was a marginal source of energy. In retrospect, we now know that that was a great underestimate because it was based on the wind turbine technologies of 1991. Advances in wind turbine design since then enable wind turbines to operate at lower wind speeds, to convert wind into electricity more efficiently, and they harvest a much larger regime, because whereas the average wind turbine in 1991 was probably 120 feet tall, the new ones going in today are 300 feet tall. Not only is it a larger regime, but the wind is much stronger up here than it is closer to the land surface. We can probably say today that those three states have enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national energy needs. Wind is a huge resource.
We can count Lester Brown among the macro thinkers who is concerned not only with climate, but with a wide range of problems facing the human project. However, like almost all our planners in this series, his emphasis is on humanity rather than the whole range of species on Earth now facing extinction due to climate change. At a different pole of society, Amory Lovins is an American environmentalist and experimenter who definitely believes that new technology could save us from climatic wreck. This is a man who goes to the high places of Colorado and builds an experimental home workshop to test out alternative energy and lifestyles. He claims to grow bananas in the winter in a home without any central heating system. The passive house he inhabits with his wife, Hunter Lovins, grabs heat from the ground and the sun and never lets it go. Lovins was a longtime environmental activist, but in the last 15 years, he has risen into the elite circles of big business and even the Pentagon. This is The Answers Man, Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute, speaking on PBS's Charlie Rose Show on November 29th, 2006.
Amory Lovins is here. He is the founder and CEO of the Rocky Mountain Institute, which is dedicated to energy research. For the last 30 years, he's been at the forefront of research into new and sustainable forms of energy. Once dismissed as crazy or irrelevant, his ideas are now being embraced by major corporations and governments. He is now an advisor to both Walmart and the Pentagon. In 2004, he co-authored a book called Winning the Oil Endgame, which was sponsored by the Pentagon. He is the recipient of numerous awards and honors for his work, including a MacArthur Genius Grant. I am pleased to have him here at this table for the first time. Welcome. And so by the year 2050, you think we could, which is 44 years from now, mm-hmm. you believe that we will what? Be?
We could be completely off oil in this country at about a fifth the cost of buying it.
Yeah.
We could get, by the way, 1 million new jobs and save 1 million old jobs that way, and get rid of a quarter of our carbon dioxide emissions that cause global weirding. And we'd make a very handsome return, which is why that transition beyond oil can be led by business for profit. We're helping that happen now. We could also have largely or wholly phased out the emissions that are changing the climate. And we'd make money on the deal because it's cheaper to save fuel than to buy fuel. Decentralized renewables, sun, wind, and the rest. And those actually added last year 4 times as much new electricity and about 11 times as much generating capacity as nuclear added. And yet the nuclear folks will tell you these are small, slow, futuristic, decades from being competitive. Well, actually, it's their central power plants, coal, nuclear, gas,
right.
that probably by now have less than half the world market in providing those electrical services for the world, because both negawatts saving electricity and micropower have taken at least the other half of the market. Nobody noticed.
Lovins has helped design ultra-light cars using carbamate instead of steel that use very little fuel. He investigates the most stingy energy mechanisms and then looks for real-world applications. His work has penetrated into the labs of General Motors, although apparently that car company didn't listen or follow through. Amory's most recent big report was co-produced by the Pentagon. The American military is deadly serious about a future that doesn't require fighting in the Middle East for oil. They want a fighting army, air force, and navy that generate their own energy and don't depend on anyone else. Although Lovins has been an outspoken critic of both nuclear weapons and nuclear power, he hasn't shrunk from working with the U.S. military. Perhaps this is appropriate since the military uses up to half the oil Americans import. It takes a lot of black juice to ship, fly, or drive all that equipment, the weapons, and the people all over America and the world. Reform there might actually help save the planet. Lovin's technical plans might make a more efficient world. His talks and ideas are exciting. In fact, he and Hunter Lovins propose a new model for capitalism, which they call natural capitalism. As a horrible simplification of a complex idea, we can say natural capitalism involves including the cost of nature in corporate bookkeeping. It attempts a money-making world that can profit from such challenges as natural shortages or even climate change. So there is a very large political and economic idea coming from the Lovins camp. We may wonder whether greed can really save the world, but short of outright revolution into completely unknown territory, some modification of capitalism is definitely required when it comes to climate change. Perhaps Lovin's proposals are just 20 or 100 years ahead of their time. We don't know. Let's get out of America and across the Atlantic to a European perspective, another journalist and book writer with a plan. George Monbiot has finished his initial book tour to promote Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning. Unlike Amory Lovins, Monbiot insists on using technology we have today to solve our problems. He points out the scientific consensus that time is short. To balance the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere in time to avert catastrophic climate change, we need to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by at least 50% by the year 2030. And if we assume that the rest of the world's population, especially in China and India, are growing toward lifestyle standards similar to our own, we will have to share that energy and other resources much more evenly than in our colonial and corporate colonial past. According to Monbiot, who cites experts he has interviewed and papers studied, that means people in the developed world must reduce our carbon emissions by a staggering 90% by 2030. That will leave just enough emissions for the developing countries to reach a reasonable living standard, development, and technology. In a sense, we need to emit much less so they can emit a bit more while they build up infrastructure, housing, and a modern economy. Monbiot investigates the various major categories of energy use in Western-style life. These include such things as heavy industry, electric power generation, and transportation. His speeches so far deal less with industry, other than a 90% reduction across the board. We presume he means alternative energy, collecting carbon dioxide for underground storage, and the like. We may have to do without certain products and processes that create climate havoc with their emissions. His plan has more detail when it comes to electricity generation. Monbiot can tolerate nuclear power as preferable to roasting without life as we know it. But he doesn't think reactors can be built in time to save us. And unlike Gaia founder James Lovelock, he doesn't see nuclear power as the answer to our big problems. Monbiot is also dismissive of small-scale electric generation as a solution to anything. A recent column in the Guardian newspaper derided Greens who mount wind generators or small solar panels on their houses. He doesn't even like distributed small-scale power systems. Let's think really big, he says, and build monster-scale alternative energy plants. He wants offshore wind farms with thousands of gigantic rotors, similar to the recent mega wind project recently proposed to help power the city of London. But Monbiot advocates using DC, direct current, to carry this alternative energy for very long distances, thousands of kilometers, with much less power loss than our alternating AC current. Using new technology for these DC cables, he foresees grabbing vast areas of the Sahara Desert for solar farms to power Europe and Africa. Meanwhile, Monbiot would rethink and retool simple transportation systems like the Humble Bus. The new bus system would operate only on existing highways. A big fleet of deluxe and comfortable buses would run constantly between towns and cities, on the highway, loading and unloading at terminals right at the off-ramps. You would reach these terminals by fast-moving mass transit from the city, like light rail or subways. The buses themselves never move into towns, where they bog down, but just move people between major locations. By being more convenient, safer, and almost a leisure time experience instead of a frightening rush hour, these buses would soak up the inhabitants of private automobiles, mainly replacing the car. The energy savings are enormous, and emissions could drop to the required 90% of current levels without giving up our ability to get around. There are many more good ideas like this in his book, Heat. Here is another proposal from George Monbiot.
It's not my own idea, but it's the one which I think makes the most sense, and this is a carbon rationing system. In concept, it's very simple. The government says this is what our total emissions for this year should be, and every year they get lower. And then we divide that total into two blocks, one of 40% of the emissions, the other of 60%. The 40% corresponds to the energy that we use directly when we are buying electricity and gas, when we pay our electricity and gas bills, when we buy gasoline to put in our cars, when we buy plane tickets and train tickets. The other 60%, that's the energy which is used on our behalf by corporations, and that 60% is auctioned off to those corporations by the government, which should do pretty well out of that auction. The 40%, which is that which we use directly, is divided by the number of people in the country, and we all get an equal share of it. And you get a carbon debit card, and every time you pay your natural gas bill or your electricity bill or fill up your tank with gasoline, you hand over your card and a little bit of your carbon ration gets taken off that card. If you run out before the end of the year, it's not the end of the world for you, but to carry on using energy, you must buy some surplus carbon ration from someone who's used less than their full ration. Because the rich tend to use more energy than the poor, this means that the rich will carry on doing that, but only having transferred a substantial portion of their wealth to the poor. And so we see an inbuilt progressivity in this system.
You can find the details at www.monbiot.com. That's spelled M-O-N-B-I-O-T.com. His talks are available at www.ecoshock.org in the Audio On Demand Climate section. I have heard him speak live, and I came away thinking we really could chart a way out of this climate mess without going into a cave.
Ladies and gentlemen, Robin Williams on the State of the Earth.
It's the end! I don't know what's happening! There are temperatures in places that no one can predict. Even Nostradamus is going New Dealer!
Back in America, Ross Gelbspan is also a credible advocate for a new alternative economy. He starts out with a vision to install carbon-free energy tech in the developing world on a crash basis. Without that, he thinks, the massive increase of oil and coal burning in China and India and all the rest of the developing countries will swamp any changes we make here as concerned consumers in the developed world. We have to bring everyone along with the new wealth that technology can create, he says, and we can't let that happen using old-style industrial carbon pollution. His alternative is to raise about $300 billion a year for 10 years to create a new alternative energy infrastructure in the developing world. Solar power galore, wind power wherever it works, big tidal power, even hydrogen as a transmission technology where needed. I haven't heard Gelbspan advocate nuclear power, but perhaps I just missed a speech. Where will this money come from? Gelbspan advocates the so-called Tobin tax. This is a tax on currency trading, which is believed to top $1.5 trillion a day. If some agency, he doesn't say which one, could grab just 0.5% of this trading, that would raise the $300 billion a year. It taxes speculation and transfers a small portion back towards actual production, the production of alternative energy devices. Perhaps a carbon tax or even a travel tax could work just as well, Gelbspan says. The actual mechanism of raising this tax money is less important than the imperative to arm the rest of the world with safe, carbonless sources of energy. In addition, Gelbspan wants a global agreement or decisions by national governments to increase carbon efficiency by 5% a year. a country or a company could produce 5% more goods using their current energy by increasing efficiency in production. Or they could institute energy-saving plans. In the first few years, he says, conservation would be the main mechanism to achieve the 5% annual efficiency gain. New technology could also help hit the target. But eventually, several years down the line, he thinks the end result would be an overall 5% reduction of carbon emissions year by year. In 10 years, this would cut carbon emissions in half if it works. We don't know how this will be measured or who will enforce it, but perhaps that's just a little too much detail to ask of one person suggesting a plan for a complex world in trouble. We may have to take Gelbspan's ball and run with it.
I believe, in fact, that if they're not right in detail, they represent an example of the general direction the world has to move. And they include a change in energy subsidy policies. They include the creation of a large fund to transfer clean energy to poor countries. And they also involve a regulatory mechanism that makes every country increase its fossil fuel efficiency by 5% a year.
Ross also wants an end to the $200 billion in government subsidies to the coal and oil industry worldwide. And he specializes in hunting down scientists and front groups who create doubt about global warming on behalf of the fossil fuel industry. Find the real guts of his plan in his book, Boiling Point, available at major booksellers, and at his website, www.heatisonline.org. Heatisonline.org. You can also find his speeches at ecoshock.org. We haven't covered another British journalist and environmental activist, Mark Lynas. Watch for his new book, 6 Degrees, coming out this spring from HarperCollins. It will show the different stages that Earth might expect for each degree of temperature rise. But I don't know if Lynas adds a plan to avoid the worst extremes. His website is www.marklynas.org, spelled L-Y-N-A-S. You can find recent speeches by our five main climate thinkers in a special section on the Radio EcoShock website called Climate Solutions. Look for it in the audio on demand menu at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. There you will find speeches with action proposals by Al Gore, Lester Brown, Amory Lovins, George Monbiot, Ross Gelbspan, and James Howard Kunstler. We'll throw in a feature on James Lovelock, too. They're all completely free to download in MP3 format. I encourage you to explore your own future and alternatives, because these are the questions you will have to answer in the next few years, at the ballot box, at the cash register, and in your own heart. How will we save this gracious and fertile planet from the perils of our own carbon garbage? How will we save the climate? It's up to you.